All right. I'd like to welcome you all to Tuesday evenings at the Modern. I'm Terry Thornton, Curator of Education, and I really love my association with this program. If you're not already aware, Tuesday evenings happen every week. This fall, they'll run into November. And I was telling someone earlier, and I just have to tell you, and you can see if you agree with me. In my 16 years of doing this, this might be the best lineup ever. I know every time I say it's great and it's hard to believe me, but I think I'm being objective about this. My challenge is that you show up every week, and at the end we'll compare notes. You can tell me if you think I'm right or not. The schedule is on the website, so I encourage any of you that did not receive it in the calendar. Members, of course, got their calendars in the mail already, I hope. With all of the programming, but if not, website is an easy way to get that information. If you want to revisit any past Tuesday evening lectures, or if you hear one, then what we strive to do is within about 2 weeks to have it up online so you can go back and listen to the podcast as well. In addition to that, there's also a blog that is happening on the website, and I think that it would be a really great place to have conversation about these lectures. I know some of you go out to dinner later or talk about it in class the next day, so let's try that out. Let's see what develops. We'll put something up and you respond, and we'll see how that goes as well. So get online, www.themodern.org. And there you will also find our schedule for the upcoming Sundays with the Modern tours that begin this coming Sunday, the 12th, at 1 p.m. with the always enlightening and ever gracious Dr. Mark Thistlethwaite, who is the Kay and Velma Kimball Chair of Art History at TCU. Each week we'll have a different perspective from a variety of talented artists and other art scholars in the DFW Metroplex on aspects of the permanent collection. They may choose to focus on the architecture or, of course, the special exhibition, which, of course, soon, by September 26th, will be Vernon Fisher, Kmart Conceptualism. As for Tuesday evenings, I strongly encourage you to return next week for what promises to be a very interesting presentation with Eve Sussman, an artist, and Kevin Mesman, editor of Rufus Corporation, as they entertain questions following a screening of White on White, algorithmic thriller. There we go. White on White. Thank you. Algorithmic thriller. This is a very interesting piece. It's only the second viewing, the second screening of it, the first being at the MoMA in June, so I'm kind of excited that we're going to be the second screening of that. Eve Sussman is actually here thanks to a partnership with SMU and TCU, in which Noah Simblist and Christina Reese were kind enough to include us. I really appreciate that. It is a very busy and exciting week with a lecture on the evening of the 15th in conjunction with what I think is going to be a very interesting, inclusion of Eve's work in a group exhibition at the Meadows Museum on SMU campus, as well as a solo exhibition installation at the Fort Worth Contemporary of TCU that opens on the 18th. Again, I ask you to visit the website for those details. Next week's presentation will be approximately 2 hours, so schedule your sitters or make your dinner plans accordingly for the screening, and then 30 minutes of Q&A with both Eve and Kevin. If the weather cooperates, I suggest that you arrive early to assure seating, since this there isn't any overflow until the cafe opens again in October, and because many people in the Metroplex saw the production, the film, The Rape of the Sabine Women in Dallas as part of the Dallas Video Fest, and it was very well received. So I have a feeling we'll get a big crowd, so I suggest that you come early. Tonight we have yet another link to SMU. Great things are coming our way from SMU, and we appreciate it. And I have to say that I think you being here is both a sign of intelligence and good fortune on your part, because tonight we have Michael Kors, professor and chair of the Division of Art for the Meadows School of Art at SMU. He is here to present No Free Reading, Interpreting Contemporary Art, Word and Image. Michael came to Dallas directly, most directly, from the UK, where he worked as an artist, writer, and professor of fine arts at the Art and Design Research Center of Sheffield Hallam University. Before the UK, Michael received a BA from Brooklyn College and an MFA in painting media from the MICA in Baltimore. It was in London at the University College that he received his PhD in the history of art. As an artist, Michael was a member of the celebrated conceptual art group Art and Language from 1972 to 1976, with work published in the group's journal Art and Language in 1973. Along with Joseph Kosuth and others, Michael was a founding editor of the artist-run journal The Fox, showing widely with Art and Language and individually, including a 1976 Venice Biennale. Michael's work can be found in prominent collections, including that of the MoMA, the Whitney Museum of American Art, the V&A in London, the Getty in L.A. Some of you may have seen his work most recently, and closer to home, as part of Modern Ruin, which was a 48-hour exhibition last February in Dallas. As the book signing indicates, and as most of you are fully aware, Michael is a renowned writer, published in important publications such as Art Forum, Flash Art, Art Plus Tax, and Mute. He is an editor of Transmission Annual, with critical writings also included in significant collections like Conceptual Art, a Critical Anthology, and Art Has No History. Michael's most recent publication is the book he was signing tonight, Art, Word, Image, 2,000 Years of Visual Text Interaction. And I have to say, if anybody's teaching a class in Word and Image, this is your textbook. It's fantastic. I've only completed Michael's writing, but I suspect that everything in it is of that quality. It was co-authored with John Dixon Hunt and David Lomas, published this year, and as you know, is available in the museum's bookstore, so I hope you'll take advantage of that. In addition, there is Conceptual Art, Theory, Myth, and Practice of 2004, as well as a monograph on David Dio from 2005, and more recently, the critically acclaimed monograph that he did in 2008 on Ad Reinhardt. This community has certainly been the beneficiary of SMU's hire. In addition to all of this and his duties as professor and chair, Michael founded the Free Museum of Dallas, a brilliant use of his office space in the Meadows, a project and exhibition space which actually opens this Friday for artist Matthew Cusick, along with the book launch for Art, Word, and Image. And it's also part of the very interesting Transmission Project, Transmission Annual Hospitality. So see what I mean by us being the beneficiaries, in case you had any doubt. Hope you can take advantage of all Michael has to offer. And tonight we begin with No Free Reading, Interpreting Contemporary Art, Word and Image. Please join me in welcoming Michael Kors.
Great. Another overachiever. Well, okay. It was good. I spent 4 hours on the runway at Mojave Airport in Houston today trying to get over here back from New York. So pretty much a nice day. The ride over was interesting, too. I've never seen a tornado up close. I'm thinking, what do you do when you're on that road going from Dallas to Fort Worth and something appears? Well, here you go. Thanks for coming. I guess we could dim the lights if, is that something? Yes. Great. Okay. First of all, thank you very much, Terry, for giving me the opportunity to come and talk about this book. I really do appreciate it. It's always a privilege and an honor to speak to an interested audience in public. And just to say very briefly a little bit about the genesis of the book, John Dixon Hunt, some of you may be aware of him as someone who's written on landscape architecture and the 18th century notion of the picturesque. David Lomas writes on modernism. And I think also John Dixon Hunt was the editor, has been the editor of an interesting journal called Word and Image, which has been around since, I think, towards the mid-late 1980s, which deals with a lot of the issues that I'm going to talk about tonight from a really vast historical sweep. So it's a tremendous resource if you have it in the library and you're interested in that. So the three of us were really brought together by the publisher, Michael Lehman of Reaction Books, and the idea was we would each do a significant chapter on a particular historical period. John wrote the introduction, and then he did the chapter that leads really up to the modern era, 1900. So he's pretty much starting with people like William Blake and Songs of Experience, a very interesting work, which was, from Blake's point of view, a critique, an attack against the rising scientism and the rise of materialism. He was more interested in the dualistic position of mind and matter, or spirit and matter, existing in the world. And he said what's wrong with materialism, from his point of view, is that it knocked out a lot of experience, and thus Songs of Experience. So that puts a different gloss on it, I think. I'm going to talk about work really that's coming from pretty much the 60s forward. My chapter starts in 1945, and I learned a lot by writing it, because a lot of the work from 45 to 60 required some research and some hard thinking about what one could say new about this particular kind of practice in art. Art, word, and image, works of art that have language in them, inscribed language or language implied in some way, some sort of text. This isn't a genre like landscape or still life or portraiture or history painting. It's more of a field that cuts across all of these different kinds of thematics, these subject matters. And it particularly comes to the fore during the emergence of conceptual art, which, in their interest in the diminished importance of the object in art and the relationship of one's understanding of art to the linguistic frameworks that we use to talk about art, this becomes particularly significant. And this is where we start to see language replacing image, or language and image together, in the form most particularly of captioned photography. It's tremendous that Ed Ruscha is going to have a huge exhibition here. I guess it's going to be next February. Fantastic to be able to see that, because he's really one of the key figures, not just in artist books, but the whole issue of photography, caption, and then word and image in art. I'm noticing that this screen is flickering. We can switch over to this other projector. We anticipated that. So I'm going to try to keep this to the allotted time, sort of about 8 o'clock. I've already given a couple of lectures around this over the last couple of weeks to kind of hone in on it. They all go over time, so there may just be an abrupt end as we approach the abyss of 8 o'clock, but let's hope not. Okay, no free reading. Art, Word, and Image After Conceptual Art, slightly different title. I wanted to pin it down chronologically, historically, as well as conceptually. Let's see if I can get the first slide on. Okay. The most interesting thing to me about having text in a work of art is that you have to engage not just as a looker, as someone who's used to gazing, perhaps being an informed voyeur, but you also have to be a reader. And these are two slightly different competences. And what happens in some of the most interesting art and word and image work is that this kind of the set of competences that are required is smacked up against each other in some sort of opposition or some sort of ambiguity or some sort of unresolved situation. And I think that unresolved situation is something that might be happening in this cartoon, which Ad Reinhardt drew in 1946. Actually, it's interesting that when I say drew, really not so much drew, because what he was doing at that point was taking old woodcuts and illustrations, line illustrations from textbooks from the late 19th century, early 20th century, cutting them out, and then doing a little bit of sketching and adding a lot of dialogue balloons to create a form of cartooning which bore some relation to Max Ernst's early work of the 1920s, but then most famous in Reinhardt's How to Look series, which he did as a kind of a comic strip for a daily newspaper in New York City called PM, because it came out in the evening. This, as far as I know, had never been published, so I found this in the archives. And the question that it raises, is art a reflection of reality, relates to his interest in abstraction and the struggle that artists of his generation had to attend to, which really was, how do you convince somebody that abstract art is about something, that it is not just decorative, that it has value, cultural value, on par with art of representation, art of verisimilitude, art that shows one a recognizable subject matter in a setting that one's body could conceivably occupy. Of course, that kind of art was not in the forefront of the avant-garde really since the mid to late 19th century, but it remained as a commonplace, a touchstone for people in terms of how they interpreted and understood art and valued it. Reinhardt's question really answers itself through his work. Art for him was about lines, color, and form, and the emotional response one has to them. But certainly at this point of the career, of his career, he was part of the whole group of abstract expressionists in New York who were constantly under siege. So you get people referring to Jackson Pollock as Jack the Dripper. You get people describing in serious reviews Pollock's work of the mid to late 40s as like a plate of macaroni and cheese, which of course is a vegetable in Texas. Okay, so we have this idea of art, and then we've got this issue of, well, what about word and image? You might be familiar with what happens to word and image in Cubism, where the introduction of newspaper, both painted and also as actual collage elements by Picasso and Braque, start to introduce the world in a different way into the picture, but also create this incredible tension. A collage is about a material on a surface, so this immediately draws attention to the fact that we're looking at a two-dimensional object. Couple that with the way Cubism treats space, the way Cubism develops a very shallow space, and you've got a very interesting proposition. You're no longer talking about the reality that is based on verisimilitude. You're talking about some kind of inventory of what there is in the world. Now, from about the late 50s forward, I would say post-abstract expressionism, I would agree with T.J. Clark that the abstract expressionists tried to do something quite unique, which was to develop an avant-garde practice within the restraints of a decidedly conventional medium, and for the most part, that was painting. When we get to the mid-50s and the 60s, you start to see all kinds of objects entering into the world of art. And in a funny way, this harkens back to the early avant-garde, the historical avant-garde of the 20s. And in a sense, that, after decades and decades, becomes the normal practice. It becomes the sign for what's progressive in art, but within the institution. Some of the issues that I want to touch on in the work we're going to look at involve the public sphere, the mass media, and other visual cultures. And by that, I mean we're going to look at, I'm going to do sort of a bit of a topology, because I think word and image lends itself to that. One can create many categories and try to develop an understanding of the work that way. This is a work from 1970 by Joseph Kossuth. We're looking at the top billboard. And I always wanted to use this. Okay. On the left, there's a bit of text that is taken from a thesaurus that deals with a particular category in the thesaurus. If you've ever had a look at Roget's thesaurus, you know they're broken up. It's broken up into categories: matter, thought, and various kinds of responses to the material and the immaterial, and so on. And on the right hand, there is the translation of this, and I understand from a native Mandarin speaker, a very bad translation of the text on the left. Kossuth would often translate the text or even just show the text in the language of the place where it was cited, because this is in New York, in an area traditionally where a great population of Asians reside. He decided to have the Chinese and English text together. It's on a billboard, so it's in a public space, the public sphere, and right below it is a typical piece of advertising that you would expect to find there. And now it's hardly either original or surprising to find art on billboards. What that does is allow the artist to address certain themes that seem to be much more appropriately addressed from outside of an institutional setting. But when this work was done, it was really about capturing for the first time this part of our environment in the city and to use it for the purpose of art. The continuation of this, flowing as well into the use of media forms, advanced media forms used in advertising, can be seen in this work by Alfredo Jarre. This is from the early 1980s. It's a screen grab of an animated work that's on this LED, large LED board that was in Times Square. And at one point, this particular LED board was curated, and a number of artists, including Jenny Holzer, many others, did projects for it. The projects lasted several minutes each, and they were shown in succession. Whether or not the people in Times Square noticed them at all, I don't know. But the fact is that they were interspersed with the regular stuff that this particular billboard was programmed with means that there was a sense of trying to see art as somehow part of the continuum of the visual flux of the city. And that's an interesting problem, and one to keep in mind, because it suggests, and this has been said before, it's not an original thought on my part, that one of the consequences of the pluralism, the so-called postmodern, or the work that starts emerging in Western art from the late 70s onwards, is this de-differentiation, the fact that art and non-art are difficult, if not impossible, to tell apart. Sometimes the only way you can decide whether what you're looking at is art is if either it has a label near it or it's in a place, a context, a particular exhibition site where you would expect to find it. Of course, this is a very interesting game, a very interesting supposition to make on the part of the artist, but it has another side to it, and that is if there is no distinction between what I'm doing and what one finds in the general environment in a city, then what can we say about the value of art? Where does it become different from all of these other things that are involved with advertising and so forth? For some artists, like Alfredo, the difference has to do with the subject matter. So the form is taken as a given, and then it's fed with a different kind of subject matter. For Alfredo, it's all about being in the West and being somehow blind to what is happening in the rest of the world. For Jenny Holzer, her work, which sometimes quotes the poetry of others, is all about the kind of immorality of war and the sense in which this kind of poetry becomes absolutely excruciating, and how this works projected as a kind of visual spectacle. And this is a work of hers that was in a recent, this is from, I think, 2004. And all of this kind of, this obsession with the environment of the city, with the visual environment of the city, with media, has an origin, actually, earlier in the post-war period. This is an example of a work by Jacques Villiglay from 68, but he started working with Raymond Hans really at the end of the 1940s, in the post-war era in France. And what they did was they would go around and look at these hoardings of posters, and they would take down large sections of them and do a lot of their own selective ripping. Sometimes they would just take sections which were quite resonant or suggestive and mount them on canvas and treat them as art. The work always was about a kind of anti-Americanism, because you have to understand that in the post-war period, the Marshall Plan was helping to rebuild Europe, which is devastated, but it also came with a price, and that was this attachment of American culture. And the French in particular were very interested to resist that. The Germans, because they were occupied, did not resist it. They embraced it and tried to assimilate it. And if you travel in Europe, you'll notice, though it's quite a... this is a phenomenon that is widespread, but in Germany in particular, you'll notice the use of English language in their advertising slogans, which I thought was very odd when I first encountered it, because there are words for everything that you could require in German. But the sense of having the English word, which is basically the American English word, had a certain kind of status, a certain sort of cultural feel, and which was quite important for some generation of German artists. Andy Warhol, of course, is the one who presents us with this dilemma. How do you tell the difference between something that looks like something else and is art at the same time? And this is what exercised Arthur Danto, who wrote about it in this wonderful book, The Transfiguration of the Commonplace. Even that language starts to bring into being this notion of a kind of metaphysical dimension to art. Transfiguration is very much a concept that we associate with religious discourse, the changing of one thing into another. It's even, or earlier, alchemical discourse, or any of these metamorphoses that we find in myth. So here, somehow, an ordinary bit of packaging, and believe me, if you've seen these in the original, there's not quite the kind of similitude that is talked about. You can tell very clearly that it is a silk-screened object. It's made out of wood, and the various roughness of it and so on really gives it away. But it's the same size, and I think for Warhol it wasn't important that it looked precisely like it, but just looks close enough, so it's almost the same, to raise the question of the difference. And Danto thought that Warhol really ushered in the period of philosophical art. He thought that Warhol was a philosophical artist. And after Warhol, Danto suggests, we have the end of art, which is this constant rehearsal or mourning for really the loss of art's position as some kind of unique, differentiable object in the world. Of course, what Warhol also did was to bring in this entire language of advertising to art, changed not only subject matter, but also the way we make art. Barbara Kruger coming to the fore in the early to mid-1980s starts to use photos that she finds out of copyright photos in the public domain, and places them with these particularly interesting texts that address an audience in the third person. So you can't drag your money into the grave with you. The shoes are quite appropriate in a way. You remember the pair of shoes in the Ad Reinhardt cartoon. Those were allusions to Van Gogh's shoes, of which Meyer Shapiro and Martin Heidegger, both wrote very important essays on the significance of this painting of Van Gogh, of his shoes, the rough hobnail boots. And here we have these stylish brogues in this kind of setup. But what Kruger is doing is activating images which are sort of free-floating with this very particular text. So here, the reading part is dominating the looking and then reflecting back on the looking. So we've got a very complex image here. It's something that's almost vibrating. Sarah Lucas, who's a British artist who is part of the young British art scene in the 90s in London, actually takes tabloid newspapers. This is earlier work from about 1990, 91, where she takes these tabloid newspapers and just screen prints them on very large scale canvases. So here we already have the sense that the visual landscape of the media, and not even the quality newspaper, but the tabloid, getting right down to the lowest common denominator of news and gossip and storing. It's sort of like, what do we have here? You have the National Enquirer. This is pretty much what the Sunday Sport is like. She's saying this is fine, and this is a particular resource that we're going to use now. The newspaper, because it's one of the ubiquitous media, also figures in the work of the Yes Men. And in 2008, they published this newspaper. This is just the front page, but the entire facsimile of the New York Times with the title Iraq War Ends. And the newspaper itself is dated, I think, July 4th, 2009. So it's a rather fantastical enterprise. People bought it at, they sold about 100,000. I think they just actually gave them away. They printed up 100,000. And here's where you've got a very familiar format. And very definitely, all of these articles are authored for the occasion of this newspaper, and the whole layout is made to look like the newspaper. So they're playing with this other visual culture outside of art. A British artist by the name of Andrew Wilson actually used to be an obituary writer for The Observer, and created a whole series of fantasy obits for pop stars and art stars. This is the one for Richard Prince. Did one for Nicole Kidman and so on and so forth. So here's how a form which we all know how to read, how to interpret, is being transformed with a very particular content. So that's one way that reading and looking can work to create this friction for an interesting work of art. This is a cell from an illustrated book by Carol Conde and Carl Beveridge called It's Still Privileged Art, which is really a narrative of their life as an artist couple. So it deals with issues of gender inequality. It deals with the problem with the market, how artists behave and what artists aspire to, and how this sometimes is in really direct contradiction to their held beliefs about why they're being artists. I love this scene. This is where it's kind of the end of a sequence that shows the collector's visit, where everybody is nervously preening and getting the things up on the wall and just sort of holding back and waiting for some kind of nod of approval from this person. And here's the end. Okay, there is a couple of drawings which are being purchased and the wine, cheese, fruit, coffee, the sort of wind down to the whole horribly anxious visit. But it's an exchange. It's a social scene that's part of the art world. The sense that artists can address the conditions of their production through art really is something that, again, conceptual art brings to the fore, a very self-reflexive, and it became increasingly self-reflexive in terms of the whole circulation of art in the system of the market, galleries, collectors, dealers, and so on. The Guerrilla Girls, again, were very interested in dealing with issues of gender inequality and racial inequality, and they came on the scene in the late 1970s and produced a lot of work around these issues, which they basically distributed as posters around the various art districts of New York and elsewhere, and sometimes published flyers and took over magazines, did guest editorships, and presented their work in that way. Finally, in 2005, they got the opportunity to participate in the Venice Biennale. At that year, it was the first Biennale ever curated by a woman. And they had a number of these, I guess we'd call them propaganda posters, because this is a tradition that they are referring to. They all have placards, and all of the text is highly polemical. They had a number of these quite large as vinyl banners arrayed in an interesting rotunda as you enter the Arsenale exhibition, which is one of the large group shows that the curator gets to put together at the Biennale. Raymond Pettibon, who didn't even go to art school, and as George Dickey never tires of remarking, is a good example of why you don't have to go to art school to be an artist. he had this wonderful facility. He was interested in punk music, and he did a lot of flyers and album covers for groups like Sonic Youth and other punk groups in the LA scene, and then eventually starts doing these quite interesting narrative cartoon-like drawings. Very, very eccentric, very bizarre, closer to R. Crumb than Rembrandt, but that's part of it. But again, it's normal for us. I don't think there's any shock to this, but it's about what language can do with images, which is to create particular narratives and to let the images work against or with the narrative, much like an illustrated novel. Here David Diao is taking another form, which is the invitation card, and using it to his advantage. As an artist who was born in China, came to the U.S. at a young age, felt that there was some difference between himself and others in New York. He uses this stereotypical image of Bruce Lee to refer to his ethnicity. And the entire card is a fantastic imaginary invitation card to his retrospective of the Museum of Modern Art. A lot of David's work turns on this idea of the other and modernism, how modernism as it was conceived, and in this sense what he means is the legacy of the ideas of Clement Greenberg in New York when he first started painting in the late 1960s, that is the idea of this post-painterly abstraction, flatness being the thing that one attended to rather than subject matter, that this always beckoned to him, but it never really accepted him, that really he starts reading modernism as a culture of exclusion and then reaches back to its earliest history in the 20th century. Three kinds of strategies that we also see in word and image art. I'll give you some examples. Gabriel Pomerant was part of a very important group called the Lettrists, which was founded by Isidore Isu, who was a Romanian artist, traveled to Paris on foot at the end of World War II, 1945, and immediately started doing work attacking the surrealists. And the basic premise was to use language in a way that is nonsensical, to undercut the surrealist idea of everything having a meaning, everything having a dual interpretation, every object really telling a certain kind of story as part of the unconscious. So this was an attempt to void culture of that and almost to start afresh. And he was in good company. Jean-Paul Sartre spoke of André Breton as being an irrelevance after the war, not least because many of the surrealists escaped to the United States in 1940, and people like Sartre and others, including Samuel Beckett, remained in France. Some of them worked for the resistance, but certainly they had no way out, and they didn't want to leave at that time. Sartre said, when everything was good in the 30s, you know, in the time of fat cows, as he put it, surrealism had some kind of resonance because surrealism was a barb against the growing commodity culture, the idea of consumption as the key central experience of life in modern society. But after the war, France, having to rebuild, as he called it, in the time of lean cows, surrealism really had nothing to say. And so Isidore Isu and other artists picked up on this and started to develop this work that really honed in on the notion of meaninglessness. So here we have a whole series of these symbols and signs, equations, and so on, as a kind of negation of meaning. Jasper Johns is really one of my favorite Jasper Johns, though it's an atypical Jasper Johns, because usually Jasper Johns, in his classical phase, where you have lots of objects and labels on canvas, is treating the canvas as if it were a museum, as if it was the meeting place for different kinds of objects, whose meaning was no longer dependent on what they were, how they were meaningful in their own context in ordinary life, but their meaning was now established by their relationship to others in this limited field. So if you come across a Jasper Johns from the late 50s and 60s, and are puzzled by it, think of it as a museum within a museum. And that might help it along. But in this case, the work that we're looking at is called Alley-Oop, and this was in the collection of Robert Rauschenberg, and it was done, I think, in 1959. Alley-Oop is a comic strip, and again, what Johns has done is to negate the text and just recolor the image as well, so you get this kind of fantastic field. It's a kind of a wiping away, a tabula rasa, a very important strategy of the avant-garde. It's also something that's being brought forward in time by an artist named Ann Charnock, who is creating these contradictory texts, these texts that speak with two voices. And this is inspired by her work as a proofreader, as an editor, and using that ridiculously devilish, diabolical even, Microsoft Word markup feature. So, I mean, can you imagine War and Peace written on a computer with markup? So here she's taking that particular thing and using it in a way that we get, because we're quite used to this kind of double meaning in the world. The excess is about a certain kind of baroque, an overuse of decorativeness, even turning the inscribed language into a decorative form. It's a spirit that comes from concrete poetry, where we see language designed on a page, oriented on a page to suggest the form that the words are actually describing, or another kind of form that competes with the actual literal language. Or in this case, Mark Titchener, he's very interested in taking advantage of what the computer can do to distort typographic forms and to create multiple layers of this kind of visual pleasure, really. And these are then output as inkjet prints and plastered on large interior spaces, and sometimes he does this as exterior posters. The mottos are always kind of banal, but that's the idea, because there's something that's quite obvious about it, and yet it's dressed up in this fantastic gown. The notion of vulgarity, then, is also something that comes to us from the not-so-distant past. This is a work of Hans Hofmann from the mid-1960s. And what's interesting about this vulgarity, and which is perhaps maybe not part of the program of artists today who are working with this excess, is how this is sort of an image of what was imagined to be the inner life of the people who actually bought these works. All I could say is read T.J. Clark on abstract expressionism. It's phenomenally rewarding and quite interesting to try to come to terms with a work like this in terms of class, in terms of post-war dynamics in post-war America, social as well as economic and political, and come to that conclusion. So very quickly it becomes much more than just an interesting composition. It becomes something else. Okay. Larry Pittman is an artist who has taken on board this notion of excess and vulgarity, and again focuses his work on that area of life that is about consumption, about commodification. These are all by now very familiar themes. They have their origins in the 60s. Invisible Colors of the Sublime. Here I thought we'd look at some of the backstories of some work that encompasses word and image. Ian Byrne, an Australian artist who I worked with in art and language in New York, died in 1993. From about 1989 to his death, he was working on these strange series of pictures, which in this case include the work, the image that you're looking at is by Albert Najimitra, an Aboriginal artist who was trained in classical art and painted aspects of the Australian landscape that were significant to the Aboriginal peoples, but for the Aussies, just represented the outback. And of course, you know, I hope you're familiar with this, the notion of land ownership, how that doesn't exist in Aboriginal culture, how the land is sacred in a way, the dream time and so forth and so on. This particular aspect of the culture within the territory of Australia becomes something that Ian Byrne is reflecting on through the use of this text. The landscape is not something you look at, but something you look through. Meaning the use of a landscape really depends on where you are in the cultural order. And Ian was very interested in this notion, this distinction between seeing and looking. He would go trawl the second-hand shops and pick up paintings and then construct a text and screen print it on plexiglass and create this interesting sandwich with the painting. And here's another version of that, where he's actually overwriting the image, which of course is one of the great concerns of people who write about art. One of the great tragedies of writing about art is that you tend to write over art, the visual. And this is a quite an old idea, this struggle between literature and the pictorial. But I think that in today's work, the struggle is not so much about where visual art and where literature fall in the hierarchy of culture, but how this presents another kind of picture of our experience of the world. Joe Scanlon is interested in this work, which he titles actually Concrete Poetry, which is a great pun, right? As he describes it, the work of famous architects is paired with a slogan that undermines them. So Gary is getting scary. He's got Marsha, Zaha Hadid is going to seed. Jean Nouvel doesn't look well, etc. You could see these on his website, which is appropriately titled thingsthatfall.com. Okay. Ed Ruscha, just a little bit. This is a work from 1998 where he's playing with these fantastic phrases. I don't know where he gets them. Maybe just picks them up from reading or just constructs them afresh. They're wonderful commonplaces, but some of them really have an edge to them. And these are then surmounted on these fantastic backgrounds, these glowing lights. Looks like the grid of LA as you're coming into the airport at night. So you've got this sense of the complete disjuncture between the text and the image that it's living with. There's not a resolution here at all. And that's important because as much as advertising uses irony and satire, there is always a resolution. There is always a directedness to it. And here we have the idea of taking that form and throwing it out, in a sense, with indirection. And I think that's very interesting. And that, in my view, I think that's what makes a lot of the recent work using word and image important, as some way of making up for the fact that it is working in quite a well untrodden field, the normal avant-garde. This is really one of my favorite Ruscha's, and that's why it's the front piece to my chapter. I think Tate Modern recently bought it. It's from 2003, so it predates the economic tragedy of 2007. The terrible deficit, the absolutely astoundingly horrifying deficit. Now, this is the Alps, or maybe the Rockies. It really doesn't matter what it is as an image. We just concentrate on the background, though background foreground doesn't make all that much sense and not fixed. It's all in motion. It's an image of the sublime, which is a very interesting concept, and it has its origins way back in classical thinking, but it comes to the fore in Western culture many times in the 18th century. In particular, Edmund Burke talked about the sublime as the terror we feel in the face of an overwhelming nature. So when we say something is sublime, there's a bit of fear attached to that. There's a bit of danger attached to that. When we say this cheesecake is sublime, well, other than the calories, not much danger. But driving from Dallas to Fort Worth with the threat of tornadoes, that was sublime. The paintings of Caspar David Friedrich with the turned figure contemplating this very harsh landscape, the sublime. But what is really interesting is that in the mid-18th century, the notion of the sublime, just when Burke is writing about this, also was attached to the enormous debt that Britain had managed to accrue after the Seven Years' War. And people had no language to talk about this. A debt that increased a hundredfold over 7 years to a figure of something over 100 million pounds. Imagine 100 million pounds in the middle of the 18th century, what that was worth. When somebody could have an allowance from their landed gentry father of 50 or 100 pounds a year and live on that for an entire year. Imagine the enormity. This figure was so enormous, people couldn't understand it. And so the discourses of the sublime and the discourses of debt actually coincided. And so, quite by chance, Ed Ruscha paints this work. Now, maybe not quite with that much contingency, because there was something called the dot-com bubble, which I believe around 2002. The first bubble was the South Sea bubble, though. That was like 1720. That was the first modern speculative bubble when things started going wrong. But it ushers in an entire new financial system. Paper money is introduced in the 18th century in Britain and made legal tender for everybody. So by the end of the 18th century, there's that. I love this work then because of the way it brings in those ideas. And that's something that the language allows us to do. Okay. I think I only have time for this one last section, but that's okay. the playwright Richard Sheridan in 1775, wrote a play called The Rivals, and in that play he introduces a character named Mrs. Malaprop. A malapropos, or malapropism, really means a substitution that's based, you substitute a word for another word based on the similarity of the sound of the word. In French, because that's where the word is derived from, the term, it means ill-suited, mal à propos. And a couple of the malaprops that come out of the mouth of Mrs. Malaprops in in the play The Rivals are as follows. You must promise to forget this fellow, to illiterate him quite from your memory. Or, it's one of my favorites, she's as headstrong as an allegory on the banks of the Nile. And if you like Laurel and Hardy, very often Stan will say, we have some, no, wait, actually not Laurel and Hardy, the Dead End Kids, the Bowery Kids, that whole series from the 30s, the Bowery Boys, one of the characters says, we have submerged victorious. So now you know what a malapropism is. And here is something that starts to approach this notion of ambiguity going a little bit further. This is the famous rabbit-duck construction, which Wittgenstein was very fond of because he uses this to explain what it is about language that's so slippery and also makes it so interesting and able to express so many different things, but also creates a problem when you try to figure out how one learns language. With all of this slipperiness, how do we ever get it right? Well, here's a man who thought a lot about language and quite a bit less about personal hygiene below the jawline. I'm not sure what that is called or what that, you know, I know what it is, but I'm not sure what it's called. And William Empson was from Yorkshire, and so is Terry Atkinson. And often Terry Atkinson would not shave below his jawline for some reason, but never went as far as William Empson. So William Empson's fantastic literary critic. You all should have a look at his Seven Types of Ambiguity, a fantastic book, which indeed is about seven types of ambiguity, but it's about ambiguity in literature, and it's quite subtle, often difficult, because he's using examples that we're not too familiar with. But the question arises, since there's so much emphasis on language in art, and we use the phrase visual language often as a shorthand to talk about what an artist does, though there's no clear analogy between what happens in language and what happens in visual forms. I thought it'd be interesting to have a look and see what one can do with this sort of ambiguity. And to go back to somebody like Ralph Romney, who was part of the Situationist International, who did these wonderful series of photographs and extended captions, which are about following someone in Venice. Sounds familiar? Sophie Kahl, are you listening? But the kinds of relationship that one has between the images and the captions is very difficult to figure out. It's a quite internalized, subjective relationship. And it was Ralph Romney who really originated this notion of psychogeography, which Guy Debord takes up in some of his works, where the actual contours of the city or the space that we're in do not correspond to the real, the concrete, but to how we perceive them, how we imagine them, what they evoke for us. And to put that into this kind of visual format means dealing with ambiguity in a very profound way. Guy Debord and Asger Jorn take this up in a series of works, two illustrated books that they do in 1958-59, one called Memoirs and the other called Fan de Copenhague, where they've really revolutionized the idea of the artist book and start to introduce this particular strategy of text and image together, which eventually became what they called détournement, or a kind of a veering away from meaning, a change of meaning. Oops. Lutz Becker actually found détournement and blows it up and reproduces it. This is Jane Fonda at a press conference in the 60s. But we have some other instances. I wanted to put this in because I like Edward Tufte. He's written some fantastic books on the visual display of information. And he's got a particular problem with PowerPoint, how it's used in institutions. Like, this is a mild use of PowerPoint. This is really just a slideshow with a couple of, you know, text slides in between. But if you work for a corporation and you go to any kind of session where somebody presents something, you know the meaning of pulling out one's fingernails slowly, one at a time. The real point that Tufte is making is how the actual structure of the program flattens whatever kind of content you want to put into it, because it becomes a kind of a straitjacket. So the analogy for him is Stalinist Russia. Okay. Ken Lum. The ambiguity here is, well, the whole setting seems to be all out of joint. His work is about immigration in Canada, this particular project, and the lack of hospitality, which is a very, you know, it's a timely subject. And he pairs these photographs with these very poignant expressions. But that it's very large, as you can see, tremendous scale, and right there, cited particularly in neighborhoods in Vancouver, where this would seem to be an issue. This is the last set of slides to talk about whether it's possible to have malapropism as a kind of a framework for making art. One talks about art in terms that are borrowed from literary criticism. We talk about particular visual tropes. Certainly the deconstructionists, Derrida, J. Hillis Miller, and many, many others talk about literature in a way that is very potent for visual art critics and artists, because there's a new vocabulary, a richer vocabulary, a vocabulary at the very least that works against the kind of materialist vocabulary of minimalism and early conceptual art. So this is a work from 1972 by Art and Language that was shown at Documenta that year. And it consists of a series of card file cabinets. And they're on plinths, but they're not to be confused as sculptures. These are drawers that you pull out, and they hold index cards like this size. And on every index, in the drawers are index cards that have excerpts of all the writing and excerpts from texts that formed the reading matter of the Art and Language group from 1967 to 1972. And the intention was that the viewer would pull out the drawer, read these cards, and add their own comments on the card, because there was lots of space on the index cards for people to write comments. Behind this display, these vertical sheets are printout sheets of their computer printouts, which map all the possible combinations of each of the cards to each of the others as a kind of a logical relationship. This is an attempt to see, well, how does this thing, this excerpt, relate to that excerpt? It's kind of like a early version of a hypertext program. So this is basically an interactive work. And it's not a work of art that we look at for aesthetic properties. It's a work of art that actually does work, which is to engage the viewer as a reader, and even more, to engage the reader / viewer as a collaborator in the piece, because what they're adding to it becomes part of it. So they become a co-author of this particular work of art. Well, that was 1972. That was in the glory days. That's when the idea of conceptual art as opening up a democratic field of art, that it was so easy and it was such an amateurish operation that anybody could do it, and you could use any materials you wanted. You didn't need any training. You could be thoroughly de-skilled as an artist and still be an artist. Some decades later, 1998, and we have what I would say is a malapropism of the index of 1972. And how is this made? Well, first of all, it's these plinths and file cabinets are made entirely of canvases, stretch canvases that have been configured to look like the original furniture. And on the canvases are screen printed particular texts. And even this last one here doesn't even have the original form of the file cabinet on the plinth. It's some other kind of mutation. The computer printout on the back has been turned into a kind of a decorative pattern, sort of these just kind of high modernist grid with no text at all. It kind of looks like a tartan, in fact. So all of that has been reduced to that decorative field. Now, what's interesting is the text that's printed on the canvas. The text that printed on the canvas is an S&M text that has been run through something like the Microsoft Word spell check. Now, this is becoming a Microsoft Word bashing lecture. I'm sorry about that. Didn't mean to. That's really glib on my part. But you know how you often do the spell check and it suggests another word, which is entirely outside of the realm of possibility because it doesn't have the word that you've actually written in the dictionary. So it guesses. And therein comes the possibility of introducing a wrong word that sort of sounds like the word you want. So you can have allegories on the banks of the Nile, even if you wanted alligators. So Wrongs Healed in Official Hope is a malapropism as the title. It's something about thongs sealed in some kind of rope. Well, now I'll get into it because this is S&M text. And all of that is screen printed all over those freestanding structures. As if to say, through the passage of time, through the intervention of the art world, through the way misreading becomes part and parcel of a work's history. It becomes the work as much as the original intention. This is all that one can hope for. Okay. I'm just going to end on one. Sorry, I've got to skip the emblem and Kara Walker, but I ran out of time. I just want to get to the last slide. Mm-hmm. A lot of these are in the book, by the way. Okay, that's it. This, I think, is what I want to leave you with. It's not John Ruskin, it's not Clement Greenberg, Harold Rosenberg, or Susan Sontag, or even Rosalind Krauss, but I think it's as good a guide as we have to how to make art today. Thanks very much.